Welcome to For the Love of Costs podcast, brought to you by the Clarion Costs and Litigation Funding Team. In this series, we will be keeping you up to date with the latest cost law development and providing you our insight into hot topics ranging from cost litigation and litigation funding to courts of protection legal costs. This podcast is provided by solicitors for general information purposes only and should not be considered legal advice. We do not make any guarantees regarding the contents of this podcast and are not liable for any losses you may incur from relying on its content. Our liability to you in relation to this podcast is excluded to the fullest extent permitted by law. If you require specific legal advice, we encourage you to contact us at clarioncosts@clarionsolicitors.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of For the Love of Costs. My name is Ellie Hunter and I am an associate in the Civil and Commercial Costs team here at Clarion, and today I'm joined by Daniel Murray, who is a senior associate in our team. Today we're going to be talking about the guideline hourly rates, a bit on the origin, the relevance of them in today's times, and the annual uplifts in line with SPPI. Thanks for joining me, Dan.
Yeah, thanks, Ellie. I thought it might be good to give a bit of a brief overview of the history of hourly rates for those who weren't around prior to their inception. So, historically, hourly rates weren't a thing when it came to solicitors' charges, and predominantly what you get was a lot of gross sum or fixed fee billing or billing based on, you know, percentage of recovery. And hourly rates really started to emerge kind of in the late 60s, developed through the 70s and 80s, and then, like a lot of things, they took off in the 90s. And that's when it pretty much became commonplace that solicitors' charges be assessed on an hourly rate and a time spent basis. Prior to the Wolf reforms and the CPR, which I know you're going to cover in a bit more detail in a few minutes or so, there were variations really of expense of time calculations for determining appropriate hourly rates. The most common one of those, and it's one that actually, despite the CPR coming into effect to remove it, it continued for a good while after the introduction of the CPR, but it was a method that involved a combination of two components, which were an A and B factor. So your A factor was the actual cost to the solicitor's firm of keeping the firm afloat, paying solicitor's wages, etc. And that was the A factor. Then it involved adding a B factor, which was the uplift based on skill, expertise, case complexity, etc. And it involved adding the two together, as I say. So, for example, if it was found that the A factor, the running costs, were £100 an hour for the solicitor running the case, and the relevant uplift was 50%, which was traditionally the starting point, then it equated to an hourly rate of £150 an hour. But after that, we had what you're going to talk about, which was the introduction of the CPR.
We sure did. So, prior to the Wolf reforms, the different regional guideline hourly rates existed, and they were locally derived and based on information gathered by the district judges and solicitors on the practice in their county court. The introduction of the CPR in 1999 required judges at all levels to assess costs summarily at the end of a trial on the fast track, or at the conclusion of any other hearing, which lasted not more than one day. So unsurprisingly, the judges then made an immediate request for guidance as to how they were meant to summarily assess these costs. That resulted in the Senior Court Costs Office Guide, which was published in 2002 and included guideline hourly rate figures.
That's right. And those were, of course, set based on location. So what you had was three bands for London, which were essentially the city centre postcodes, central London, outer London, and then we had another three guideline bands, national band 1, 2 and 3, which incorporated various different locations. Band one, those deemed to be the most expensive locations for solicitors to practice. Band three, those deemed to be the cheapest or the ones of the lowest cost. Different city centres.
Yeah.
Or different cities could have different bands. For example, I remember when I was training, you'd be on Google Maps looking how far away the solicitor's firm was from Newcastle Art Gallery or Leeds Museum, I think it was, something like that, to calculate which band they belonged in. And that was how it went. There was a lot of arguments that developed on that point. There was two cases, which I think, and you know, I still see them in points of dispute by paying parties today, arguments based on location. Two big cases of Wraith v Sheffield Forge Masters and Truscott v Truscott.
Yeah.
Essentially, they were decided based on whether it was reasonable for litigants to instruct firms that weren't local.
Yeah.
To the claimants. Case of Wraith decided that it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
The Wraith v Truscott brought in some other factors, namely skill and expertise. The solicitors in that firm, I believe, were a specialist in the area. So hourly rates outside of the claimant's location were allowed. Rates in a higher band were deemed reasonable at assessment. And that was how, that was tended to be the way that things went.
Yeah. Like you said, Dan, the interesting point is that the guideline hourly rates based on location, as you touched on, especially with the National 1 compared to National 3, different cities, it's going back to the A factor, and the overheads of the firm are going to be more expensive in, say, Leeds city centre as it would be in a small village. So it's the same things that are impacting. It was just a new system which was then uniform nationally. But like you say, it doesn't end there, because then you get arguments as to whether you should have instructed someone in a different band, and you have those Wraith and Truscott arguments. So there's still a lot going on with the guideline hourly rates, and it didn't necessarily resolve all disputes as to what should be charged. And since 2002, with the introduction of those guideline hourly rates, they have increased a couple of times. We had the 2010 guideline hourly rate increase, which was based on a simple inflationary uplift on the 2009 figures, which was accepted by the Master of the Rolls as an interim measure. In 2011, the Master of the Rolls did not feel that he was able to set rates on the basis of a further recommendation from the Advisory Committee on Civil Costs for another purely inflationary index-linked calculation, without a broader base of evidence having been sought from practitioners as to whether they were reasonable or reflective of the market at that time, which I can understand the logic in, but what it left us with was actually worse, because we then had 11 years of no guideline hourly rate increases.
That's right, and we still had those arguments about location. Was it reasonable to instruct a London firm when you're in a National 1 firm, etc., etc.? But for everyone who was involved in costs or just litigators in general, and during that period, what we had was a long period of arguments regarding, you know, deviation from those rates and what was the relevant appropriate uplift. And of course, the pillars of wisdom, originally seven, now eight with the introduction of budgeting, were considered. There was arguments back and forth, and by the large, apart from in summary assessments, it was quite common that the guideline rates were just that. There were the guidelines, and uplifts were awarded at detailed assessments up and down the land, but there was no set factors. It was a case-by-case basis. But one of the driving factors was, of course, that there hadn't been an uplift for so long, until 2021.
Absolutely. And then in 2021, we had the increases, which were approximately 20%, which was necessary in light of the 11-year period of waiting for them. And interestingly, the London One band was also amended in 2021, as it was not then to be based on any particular London postcode, but, quote, very heavy commercial and corporate work by centrally based London firms. So we then had a slight deviation, didn't we, from the Guide and Alley Rate bands being solely geographical and moving more towards the nature of the work involved?
Yeah, we did. As you say, I mean, there's still reference, obviously, to centrally based London firm, but, you know, what central? We're going to have different everyone's going to have a different interpretation on that. But you're right, it was a slight shift away from the location point being setting the guidelines to actually, are we now going to set this based on the nature of the work, the complexity of the work? Of course, it's only in the London band one. It never filtered through the other bands. That those are all still based on location, but it was a change to the way things were in the 2010 rates.
Yes, exactly. And it stayed that way since 2021. In May 2023, we had the Civil Justice Council publish their cost review. That was accepted by the Master of the Rolls, and that led to then the guideline hourly rates being uplifted in January 2024. In accordance with the Services Producer Price Index, otherwise abbreviated to SPPI, and it was also agreed that the guideline hourly rates would then be uplifted on an annual basis in accordance with SPPI, which has recently happened in January of this year, 2025. And like I say, it's now going to be on an annual basis, and we won't have the same as the 11-year wait we did from 2010 to 2021.
That's right. But whilst that's good news, do you now think, I'm going to put you on the spot here, that it means the pillars of wisdom become less important when it comes to assessment? Because one of those long arguments was, we need an uplift, or an uplift is justified because we're so out of date with inflation. Obviously, that wasn't the only factor, but it was a key factor, or a big factor. So now we've got that regular yearly update. Is it in the pain parties? Is the upper hand to the pain party when it comes to the hourly rates arguments?
Yes and no. I think on your, what I'll refer to as run-of-the-mill cases, that there is no uplift that can be justified by the pillars of wisdom. You're unlikely to get any uplift because inflation is already accounted for in the annual uplifts. However, I still think that the pillars of wisdom will be very relevant for a lot of cases. There's some cases we're going to come to in a minute, but guideline hourly rates are a starting point at detailed assessment, not a finishing point, which was in the case of various claimants v News Group Newspapers Limited. And essentially in that case, the judge said that the guideline hourly rates are a starting point, is no more than a reflection of the scarcity of any other starting point. They have to start somewhere, but that does not mean it is the finishing point. And that's particularly so where the court has the opportunity for the parties to address it in detail in respect of the CPR 44.4 factors. So in answer to your question, yes, it might be in the paying parties' interest in some ways, in that there's no longer the argument that there should be an uplift for inflation, but you're still definitely going to have arguments of uplifts based on the pillars of wisdom, you know, your sums in issue, your complexity, the skill of the fee earner, the responsibility involved on the cases to which that applies. However, there is the opposing case of Samsung, isn't there?
There is, but that, so the issues you touch on, as you say, is there's the chance when the pillars of wisdom can be addressed in detail, and that's at a detailed assessment. So there's a lot more
time to go through this argument, and you know, rightly so, that there should all be factors to, you know, justify uplift. Samson was a case that applied to summary assessments, where, yeah, of course, there isn't the time. It's at the end of a trial. It's at the end of a interim hearing. And that decision was quite clear that there must be a clear and compelling justification to depart from them. So the position, you would think, it doesn't necessarily mean that there wouldn't be an uplift, but the take on it has to be, unfortunately for a receiving party who wants to seek an excess, when you're having some costs summarily assessed, there must be that really clear and compelling reason. Of course, there's less time for counsel or an advocate to make submissions,
yep,
for a departure, less chance for a judge to consider. So the realistic outcome is, when you're getting costs summarily assessed, more likely than not, there's going to be the application of the guideline hourly rates.
Yeah.
And just to, talking about assessment there, but I think because it's current, it's only been in the legal press in the last couple of weeks or so, again, in particular, but it's worth pointing out that since the CPR cost budgeting's being introduced, of course, it's not the role of the court when making a cost management order to set an hourly rate, but it is a factor that they consider. And recent case of GS Woodland v RGCM Limited just emphasised that the court will take a look at the rates,
yeah,
at that stage as well. So it's something else that parties need to be mindful of. In that case, there was a rate in excess of £1,000 an hour sought. It was one of those cases that would be a band one London case, the very heavy commercial work. As I say, the court couldn't reduce the rate, but what you saw was significant reductions to the sums claimed.
Yep.
Within the cost budget, the likelihood being that those reductions factored in significantly less hourly rates than were being claimed, and actually it resulted in the claimants not recovering the costs of the cost management process and those being awarded to the defendants because of the level of those reductions. So
yeah,
there's an extra layer,
yeah,
to think about, rather than just assessment of fees. The rates obviously have a significant impact on cost budgeting as well.
Yeah, very true. And I think the judge in that case, that GS Woodland case, said that the hourly rates claimed were implausible, and that it was pretty obvious what the court's approach would have been to the rates claimed. And like you say, Dan, they can't assess or set the hourly rates, but they can comment on them. And those comments will likely, I'm sure, be on the paying parties, on the paying party submissions when it comes to detailed assessment.
Yeah, and difficult to overcome.
Yeah.
You'd assume for the receiving party, but...
Absolutely. So, like we said there, there's the hourly rates impact upon your cost management, your summary assessment, and your detailed assessment. They really are vital to what your recovery is going to be on an inter-party basis.
They are. And then where does that leave us? Where does that leave us, really, then? We've done the history. We've done what's happening now.
Yeah.
What happens next?
Well, it's interesting because I've seen several LinkedIn posts, really, and it's been flying around legal commentary for the past 5 years since the COVID pandemic, because since then, there's been a shift in the change that people work. We have a lot more hybrid employees, remote employees. So when guideline hourly rates are so heavily influenced by geographical location, what do you think, Dan? Do you think that it's going to be a common argument coming from paying parties that, I don't know, a firm's based in London, but one of the employees works 4 days a week in, I don't know, Chester? Then is that going to be an argument as to it should be band two rather than London one?
It's difficult. It's a good question. You're right. There is a lot of talk or a lot of comment on the issue. I think, and this is just my own view, for a for an argument to be successful on that one, you've got to have the case that there shouldn't be any uplift because of the pillars of wisdom. Two, I think you need clear and compelling evidence that, you know, Fiona was sat, as you say, in a band two,
yeah,
we can call it, location, doing all the work. And three, good arguments that they should be restricted, as, you know, firms have, they've still got to pay rent, they've still got to pay utility bills, you know, the costs
of running the office, whether the Fiona's there or not, the overheads are still being incurred.
So it'd be interesting. I'm sure we're not too far away from a case of this type being reported when, you know, one part, when the, you know, paying party might think the stars align and they've got everything in their favour. And you know what, they may just do that. They may convince a judge that reduction should be made for that reason. Who knows? Who knows? But I do think we're not too far away from seeing it raised, what way the court would give it and whether they decide to go down that route. Who knows?
Something to watch out for, I suppose.
Certainly.
But thank you very much for joining me, Dan, and thank you everyone for tuning in and listening.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, please don't forget to like, subscribe and share with your network. To ensure you are keeping up to date on all things cost, make sure to sign up to our newsletter mailing list below. We look forward to welcoming you to the next episode.